Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore, and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to the social factors that impact migration, early careers and diverse voices in science, climate journalism, being sporty in a sporty family, amongst other things. Got your brew ready? Great. Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Coffee and Geography. And I'm going to be fangirling a little bit here because I'm joined by someone who works for one of my favorite science communication outlets out there. But I honestly did not know that she worked for this until after she signed up for the podcast, because I met her in another way. But Aisha Tandon, it's lovely to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Kurt. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Yeah, so I'm talking about Carbon Brief, folks. And if you haven't heard of Carbon Brief, you sure will by the end of this podcast. But Aisha is not just a science journalist at Carbon Brief. She's actually the third generation of woman to study physics in her family, but the first person in three generations not to get a PhD. Stepping away from research with support from her family, don't worry, was a big decision for Aisha, but definitely the right one. Her work in climate science is a much better fit. As well as writing, Aisha is super lucky that she gets to go to conferences, meet cool scientists, and even did some fieldwork in Thailand last year. Ooh. She also has worked on improving global South representation in climate journalism. That's a brilliant, brilliant intro.
Well, thank you. Thank you for reading it all out. Yeah, as you said, I am the first person in my family in three generations not to go down the kind of academic route. So I'm glad I get to say some other cool stuff about myself instead.
Yeah, and we won't go into it because probably you and your family have had that discussion. It's like, you've broken the doctor chain.
Yeah, I think they were very supportive of that because, my parents both did PhDs, but I have to say they didn't love them. And so actually I think the decision not to do a PhD was, I think they were quite happy for that for me.
Yeah. No, and actually, a lot of people, when people talk to me and we talk about the kind of work I do, which is very similar to the work you do, like a lot of people are surprised that not only do I not have a PhD, I don't even have a master's. So the highest qualification I have, is a bachelor's degree, and then the postgraduate certificate of education on top of that. So I do have a level 7 qualification, but yeah, not a master's. So it's not, you know. It doesn't have to happen, folks.
I guess that goes to show there are lots of different ways of getting your knowledge in.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we'll definitely be talking about, we'll be geeking out about science communication, things like that a bit later. So first of all, we've already disclosed this morning, folks, that both Aisha and I are on the water this morning. We just need to get those fluids in. And how's the weather where you are? Because, of course, folks like us, we actually talk about the weather and the climate. So, but the sun is finally here. It's the beginning of March. What about in Oxford?
It's actually sunny outside, which is brilliant. It's cold. It's a cold, sunny day. Mm. But I'm definitely looking forward to going for a lunchtime walk today after this.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking at my weather console at the moment because I've got a personal weather station out in the garden, and we have at the moment it's reading a northeasterly wind, which kind of makes sense, the fact that the temperature is pretty chilly, because folks, without that wind it would be slightly warmer, but currently here in Norfolk it is 8.6 degrees Celsius, but it feels a bit chillier than that. It's got a bit of a wind chill to it. But it's lovely. Spring is here, and I suppose we're going into talking shop already. We want a better March, don't we? Because it's been the warmest and wettest February on record, I believe, at least for the United Kingdom.
So I actually did some analysis recently for Carbon Brief, where I was looking at hundreds of years of data from the Met Office, which was pretty cool. And I was looking at how UK winters are getting warmer and wetter. And we were looking at these trends of how flooding is getting worse and sort of what we would consider winter is basically getting a lot warmer. So I think we're seeing those trends already. It's kind of crazy to be writing a piece and be able to look out the window and see exactly what you're writing about happening in real time.
Yeah. In fact, that's that's for me the thing that's I find both fascinating and scary at the same time. I mean, that's something I really wanted to speak to you about, is because we both work in climate science communication, it's almost like we have this morbid fascination and excitement about what's going on. We know it's serious. We know it's not right. We know it's devastating for a lot of people and it's going to cause a lot of suffering. But from a meteorological, climatological point of view, we have changed the world into a living experiment, into a real-time experiment. Now, from a scientific point of view, that's really interesting. That's really exciting. But of course, from a humanity point of view, this is exceptionally concerning. And people keep asking me, how do you square that circle, Kit? How do you keep talking about these kind of things when you know what you're talking about is, you know, for a lot of people, a lot of cultures, a lot of societies, it's existential, is this threat. So when you look out your window and you go, like I do, this is not right, this should not be happening, I'm concerned about this, but it's also fascinating. How do you square that circle yourself in your mind?
I think you're right in saying it's almost a kind of a morbid curiosity. Like, I remember writing about the UK's 40 degrees C heat when first breached 40 degrees, and all of us at the Carbon Brief were sitting and basically waiting for the Met Office to make this official announcement. And I was like sitting sweltering in my very, very hot house, writing about the heat, thinking about the heat, feeling the heat. And it's as you said, it's kind of trying to get your head around the fact that this is something that everybody is experiencing. And yet we are the people who are actually communicating and sharing the information. I guess that's how it's knowing that we're providing that service of keeping people informed. It means that we have to be interested in it and we have to be curious about it. And it is a scientifically a very interesting phenomenon. So I guess that's how I kind of square that circle.
Yeah. And I see it. And I think a lot of the thing I really, really like about Carbon Brief in particular, the reason why I subscribe to it is because for a start, it does an amazing job of taking exceptionally complex information and distilling it down. And it's been, I've used it, I've recommended it to a lot of teachers. And when I give talks, I'm always referencing it and I'm always showing, I'm always showing the pitch from it. Like one of the things I used a lot the latest one I think was 2022. I don't think it's been updated since, is the, for example, the climate attribution map, where you've got worldwide extreme events and then you've got geolocated around the world to where they're talking about, and then it links to the scientific climate attribution study to say whether there was a human fingerprint in that event. And then but Carbon Brief distills it down to say quite simply, yes, there was a signal. Think there's a signal, but we don't know if it's statistically significant, or no, there's no signal. Simple as that, three categories. But if you want to, you can then click on it and actually go to the scientific paper. And that's just brilliant.
That map is a fantastic resource. It was the brainchild of my boss, Carbon Brief science editor, Rob McSweeney. But I will say that's actually the project that I'm working on right now. We're trying to update it in the next kind of 6 months.
Yeah. You see, folks, I've punched the air, but I didn't punch the air as in, yes, we're going to have a map of all the more kind of dangerous, awful stuff. I punched the air because of the communication, the science of it. And it's so important. Yes. Yeah, so sorry, I cut you in my excitement of the data coming out. I've cut you off there. Sorry. So yeah, you're okay. I don't know how much you can say. You might not be able to say too much. You might not be able to give spoilers.
I've got to keep some suspense, you know.
Cool. As you were saying, you were going to
absolutely. So, I mean, it is a brilliant resource, and actually Carbon Brief is the only organization that has a resource like this. So we are referenced by people like the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, like all of the experts who want to talk about attribution, they reference our map. And a lot of people, including you, have started asking us, when is the next update coming? So attribution science is this fairly new field. And so when the map was first contrived, there weren't a huge number of studies to go on there. And now every time we update it, there are just more and more and more studies. And it kind of gets to this point where there's so much work to do that we put it off, and then the work just keeps piling up. So we've now got to a point where we definitely need to update it, and we're having to figure out how we go about doing that in a way that's actually sustainable and doesn't end up taking, you know, the rest of my job for the rest of my life to keep doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm guessing this is I'm now circling back to my first episode of this season, like with artificial intelligence. I might have to employ a little bit of artificial intelligence to help you out with this, you know, because it's so much is coming, and of course it's only ever going to get more and more and bigger, isn't it? It's
exactly, because,
yeah, it's just such a huge thing. And one thing that I've been pushing for in climate science education, especially at secondary level, so I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, we should be doing this, you know, at post-secondary level and universities and stuff like that. With 100%, but I'm kind of like on a self-led campaign, if you like, on trying to get climate attribution, the science of that, and what it means and what it's actually taught at secondary level, because that's how important I think it is. Yeah, so I won't. Obviously, this podcast about you, but for folks who might be interested in that, this is something which is very, very important to me, because it helps with the things like the misunderstanding, the misconception of climate science. It kind of helps to combat climate denialism and even climate doomism as well, because the more things you can attribute to human activity, then actually it kind of tells us we actually have more control to deal with this than people realize. So
that's a nice way of framing it, actually.
Yeah, because if it's all quote unquote natural, or if they're all popping up and there wasn't a human fingerprint in most of these things, you'd be like, well, we're screwed because we can't do anything about it. But actually, you look at it the other way, say, no, we can deal with this, you know. So yeah, that's the other way I square this circle. It's knowing that we can do something about it, you know. Before we keep going off on the whole climate carbon brief stuff and the science communication, because we can do the whole hour on that basically. So you're currently located in Oxford. Is that somewhere where you've been born and bred? Are you an Oxford person, or have you come to that place in recently?
I mean, close enough. I grew up in Reading, which is about a 45-minute drive away. So that's where my parents are. I went to Exeter for university, and that's where I met my now boyfriend. And he's actually just finished his PhD here in Oxford, which is why I decided to move here so I could be with him.
Well, at least one of you is a doctor then. Keep the parents.
One of us is a doctor. It'll be Dr. James and Aisha.
Nice. So, yeah, You're still in the same part of the world, you know, Oxfordshire, but Berkshire, that area. But I know that you've done a lot of traveling. And as you've said here, that your family is very international, you've traveled a lot, and you went to the rainforest in Malaysia when you were a tiny baby. Now, I'm not going to assume you can remember any of that trip in particular, of course. But
definitely not.
But one question I like to ask people on this podcast is, so you've got, obviously, your identity has been built by the fact that you've lived in the Reading, Oxford area pretty much all your life. But you've done all this traveling. You've got an international family, as you say. So the places that you've been, the places that you've experienced, the places that I suppose you've inherited as well through your family, how has that formed your identity? Is there any particular part of where you've been or where you're attached to that's like, that's a strong core part of your identity? Or are you like, I'm just so through and through, I just feel like a Berkshire lass, or, you know, completely. What's informed your identity through location, Aisha?
That is a question that I could spend the rest of the day talking to you about, but I'll try to keep it brief. So my family, my mother is from India. My father was born in Uganda, but his father is Indian and his mother is Malaysian Chinese. And so I already have quite a lot of different cultures just through my family background. But as you say, I was born in the UK. I've only ever lived in the UK. I speak English. It's my only language. And so growing up, I definitely felt very British. And I think I've only started to explore this other side of my of my personality, of my identity, of maybe not just being a Berkshire lass, as you said, maybe in the past 5-10 years when I've started to think more about diversity and inequality and that kind of thing. And so definitely as a kid, I traveled a lot. Like, we would go on big holidays once, twice a year. My dad even worked in China for a few months, and we just all decided to take off and live with him in China. And that was just very normal for us. We did a lot of traveling. But for me, I think the way that culture has really influenced me, my upbringing has always been through food. So my mum always used to cook these big Indian meals or Chinese things or Thai. Like, I didn't eat a lot of British food growing up. So for me, that's always the thing. It's when I go traveling, it's like, oh, what kind of Asian foods can I eat and can I enjoy? So I definitely don't just feel British, despite only speaking English and despite having lived in England my whole life. I definitely do feel very connected to these other places that are kind of a really important part of my identity. But it's more through the culture and how that's been passed down through my family rather than necessarily having visited there. Because whenever I was visiting places, it was always as a kind of tourist, as a traveler, someone who didn't speak the language. As I said, this is something I could speak about for hours and hours and hours, but that's the brief summary.
That's so amazing. So yeah, so identity through food in particular. So I must admit, when I wasn't expecting that answer, but now that I think about it, it makes total sense, as food is such a massive part of culture. A couple of weeks ago I went down to London and we had our first decolonizing geography gathering where we met in person for a first time for a while, and that was absolutely beautiful. And so what we did, we were in Tottenham, which people will know I'm a Spurs fan, so that was quite cool. So we were in the Burnley Arts Centre in Tottenham, and just up the road there was a Nigerian restaurant. Ooh. So what we decided to do is that we decided to source our lunch from them.
Amazing. They did
and oh my God, it was so rich and gorgeous. I mean, I've experienced a lot of different foods from around the world, I just can't describe it, folks. If you're the kind of person who sticks the same food over and over again, fine, you know, comfort in you with the foods that you know, great. But my goodness, please try something new every now and then. I'm actually going to get in contact with those folks and see if they want to come on the podcast, because I want to talk about how I haven't actually spoken to anyone who's like been a chef or anything like that, or so that would be amazing. But yeah, food. You can almost, this is going to sound really cliche, but you can taste culture through food, because
absolutely
the way they did the bean curds, the bean suet stuff in that Nigerian dish was very different to the way you get it in a Chinese dish, for example. Even though it's effectively the same thing. Because I love eating, you know, Chinese, Indian, stuff like that, but very Western, admittedly very Western Chinese, very Western take on that. What is your, this probably will be an impossible question for you then, I guess. What is your favorite food then? Or your favorite?
I am going to take that question and just change it a little bit to ask what is my comfort food, my most familiar food, because that's a question I know I can answer. Favorite food, that I have too many things. But for me, growing up, my like favorite food that I used to eat when I was a kid and when I was a toddler was a combination of rice, yogurt and saag, which is like Indian spinach, and salt, and you mix it all together and it makes this big old mush. It was kind of like my baby food, if you like. That's my comfort food.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's my comfort food after a long day at work. That's what I will eat, or for breakfast most days, that's what I eat, actually. I will always have at least 2 or 3 Tupperwares of that in the freezer, because that's what I like to eat as my like comfort, relaxing food. If we're talking favorite foods, I would maybe go something maybe Vietnamese pho, like broth. I do like a good soup, something like that. But that's hard to make at home, so it's definitely not something I eat as often.
Very nice. Yeah, I love a good saag as well. Like every time we go for Indian, it's like it's got to be some kind of saag dish, saag paneer or something like that. Yeah, I do like
absolutely.
I love the way that Indian cuisine does spinach. I don't think anyone else does
so
it.
So good.
Italian second close with spinach, but Indian definitely my top.
Italian for me is very difficult. It's a lot of like pasta and pizza and stuff that I just didn't grow up eating at all. So for me, that's all quite rich and difficult. I think Asian food sits with me a lot better than European food.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because a lot of people would say the other way around, wouldn't they? Well, I guess if you're European, white European, Western European, it would... Folks, I don't have any scientific study to back this up. This is all completely anecdote and observation. But I'm wondering if that's a thing. Like white Western Europeans, pasta, you know, that's... We've got that. It's not just an Italian dish anymore. It's a Western European dish now, isn't it? Pasta and lasagna and stuff like that. And then a lot of people say, "Oh, I can't eat Indian or I can't eat Thai or stuff like that because it doesn't sit with me." Not for any other reason, but it just doesn't sit with their bodies, right? I want to know anyone out there. I've got to get a chef.
There is definitely a genetic component in that. For example, I am much more likely to be lactose intolerant. The people from those parts of Asia are much more likely to be lactose intolerant. I'm sure there is a genetic component. I'm sure it's also just based on what you grow up eating. Like, I didn't really grow up eating a lot of that kind of pasta, pizza, heavy carby stuff. I grew up eating rice like every single day. So
yeah,
I guess it's a bit of both.
Yeah. Oh, that's so fascinating. Oh, yeah, we've definitely gone off piece now, but that is so fascinating. Oh, right. So let's go back to travels then. So you've got, you've experienced different language. And as you said here, you experienced different cultures, language, foods, etc. at an early age. It was very formative for the way you see the world. So I imagine, I mean, this is a leading question, but I imagine you see yourself as a global citizen. In that kind of sense, but where's been your favorite place or your most memorable place to go visit? You said you were in China for a few months, for example, but if someone says, "Aisha, I'm going to give you a ticket for free for any, and like a blank check, but a blank destination," like what would you do?
I think maybe Thailand. So as I think I mentioned, I went to Thailand last year to do some field work. I was looking at climate-driven migration, and I visited all of these rural communities up in the mountains, and I was talking to people about their experiences of climate change and migration, and I just actually felt very at home there. There was something about the culture and the food and the way that people interacted with me that just felt very familiar and comforting, and I really enjoyed it, and I had an amazing time meeting all of the people that I met. But I would love to be able to go back there, not for work, like to actually be able to go and see other parts of Thailand, the culture. I mean, I'm going to Vietnam with my boyfriend in a few months, and I think that's going to be amazing. It's a place I've wanted to visit for years. I think anywhere in that part of Asia I think would be incredible.
Can you pin down exactly what it is that they do differently, the Thais, in terms of the way they interact socially?
Well, so I mean, I think food, again, you can probably tell I'm quite a foodie. The food, for example, the culture around food was fantastic because no one drank alcohol, no one was smoking, no one was drinking coffee, which are all things that I don't do. And when I went to Italy, for example, for a conference, dinners would be this 3-hour event where everybody was smoking and drinking coffee and drinking alcohol and being very loud. And for me, I found that quite a lot. That was quite stressful. In Thailand, lunches were this half an hour thing. You just get your little bowl of soup and you eat your bowl of soup and you drink your glass of water. And then you all go home or you go somewhere else to relax. Like the atmosphere isn't around being out late and boozing and smoking and all of that kind of stuff. It was a very different cultural experience. And for me, that was perfect because that's what I'm like. I'm not really a big coffee drinker or alcohol drinker or smoker. Like, that's not how I like to relax. So even just that, the fact that I didn't have to sit through these 3-hour conference dinner things. Instead, we just go grab a bite to eat and then we would have a walk and have a chat afterwards instead. Culturally, that was just kind of how I would have chosen to do things if it was up to me.
I'm with you on that one. I like more intimacy than big group stuff and like to overstructured things. So I'm with you on that one. And you mentioned you're heading off to Vietnam, so I just want to give a shout out to my ex-colleague who used to work with in Norwich for the World Energy and Meteorology Council, and that's Lin Ho. And Lin is from Vietnam, and she's I think she's moved back out there to do some work with renewable energy, but folks can get to know Lynn because I spoke to her on this podcast, I think a couple of seasons ago. So folks, if you want to hear more about Lynn's take on being Vietnamese and things like that, you should definitely listen to that because that was a brilliant listen.
Are you a business or organization passionate about ethical practices, products, and systems? Is being sustainable, inclusive, and equitable core to your values? And do you want to spread the word amongst listeners who share these ideals? Then sponsor the Coffee and Geography podcast. There are pricing options to suit a range of needs, and you know you are supporting independent educational efforts that aligns with your aims. Visit bit.ly/coffeegeogpod for more details.
I want to know more about this thing you did in Thailand, because migration is such a hot topic, and we know that that wasn't a pun, sorry. But especially climate migration. So yeah, what can you tell us about that work then? About because that sounds absolutely fascinating, and it's I think it's something that's going to appear quite a lot now on people's radar about migration based on climate and climate change.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I'm currently working on a 15,000 word explainer on the topic. So if you want lots of detail, give it a couple months and you can listen to that. So basically this work, which I should say was funded by the European Geosciences Union. So thank you for that. This work was looking more at the social factors impacting migration. So there's a lot of modeling studies around the physical climate changes that might impact migration, that might cause people to move. And I've written a lot about that in my explainer. But there actually isn't that much work on the social drivers. So for example, if somewhere gets on paper too hot for people to live, a model might say, okay, people are just going to move. But can people move? Do they have the social capital to move? Do they recognize that the climate's actually changing? Where would they move to? Does it impact their families? What demographic of people might move? There's all these kind of social and economic factors that just haven't been well studied because social science is a lot more difficult to get those kind of answers for. You need to talk to so many different people to get a good representation. And so I was working with this team called Habitable. It's a 4-year massive research project that scientists from 5 different countries across Africa and Asia are going and conducting tens of thousands of surveys of people like the farmers that I was speaking to in Thailand and asking them all of these questions. And the awesome part about this project is that the funding comes from the EU, but it goes to researchers who are based in the local countries. So when I was shadowing these researchers, they were all local Thai researchers. Actually, a lot of people conducting the interviews were from the villages themselves. Like they were interviewing their like friends and family. So it really was like ground up locally led, which is fantastic. And so I was there sort of following the researchers and learning how they were conducting their research. And then I also got the chance to speak directly to a lot of these farmers about their perceptions of climate change and migration. What I found was actually people are very aware of the changing climate. They might not use the phrase climate change, but they will be very aware that, oh yeah, last year there was a really bad flood that wiped out my rice crop. And we've never seen a flood like that before. And it's getting more common. Or yes, the winter is not as cold anymore and it's not killing all of the bugs that we need it to kill. And so our plantations of trees aren't doing as well, that kind of thing. They were really able to speak very eloquently about that. And then I learned a lot about the different migration patterns people are using, seasonal migration patterns or actually moving permanently or maybe not being able to move or not wanting to move. There's also a big problem of immobility, of people not having the resources need to move. So that was brilliant. It was really interesting. And migration is a topic that I have always found very interesting, I think partly because of my family background as well. This project was fantastic.
That's amazing. This is actually very serendipitous because one of the new resources I'm working on is trying to move away from this push-pull model of migration, because that's all about that's all about the reasons. It doesn't give any agency to the people who it's involved. And so when you said about working directly with, the Thai researchers, for example, I mean, this is right in what you say, you're improving global self-representation in anything, not just, you know, and science in a lot of places around the world is seen as a colonial process itself. Geography is most certainly seen as a colonial process in a lot of ways. So as I'm trying to move away from this whole push-pull kind of way of looking at migration, I've looked at the most recent studies which looked at kind of what you've just been mentioning about how there are different scales of influence, like the things that I've seen is like macro scale influence, which means things outside of people's control, like geopolitics, globalization, climate change to an extent, trade, international trade. Then you've got mesoscale things, which is like whether the place they might want to move to has migrant communities or not, how their culture sees women and girls. And then you've got micro scale things, which is all about them individually, their belief systems, their attitudes, their aspirations, their jobs, their stuff like that. Yeah. So what you've, it sounds like the work that you've been doing, like, is just a perfect demonstration of like, we can't look at migration in black and white. There's actually all these things, and it doesn't lead to people just leaving. It leads to the choice whether they can stay or leave.
Absolutely. And I think there's this really interesting difference between migration and displacement as well, which is displacement would be, for example, if there's a flood and your house gets washed away and you have to leave, right? You have no choice. You have to get out of there, and you'll just go to wherever the closest place is that is safe. Whereas migration is this decision that you make after, I mean, it could be years of sort of thinking and planning, and maybe climate change causing conditions to deteriorate, or the politics in your country causing your home to become less habitable. And eventually it's this decision that you come to, that you want a better life, and then you decide to move. And that's this really interesting distinction that I've been sort of looking at as well.
Oh, I could, again, and yet another topic with you, Aisha, that I could talk about forever, but we should move on.
Yes.
So the way that we came to meet each other is through the Royal Meteorological Society's Youth and Early Careers SIGS, which is a special interest group.
The Royal Meteorological Society is basically the UK's group for advancing knowledge and understanding about weather, or weather and climate maybe. And so the SIG that that you and I met at is basically the it's called a special interest group. So it's a group of people, nerds like you and I, who are really interested in weather and climate, and who are interested in the society in general. And basically we provide our thoughts and opinions to try and help the society engage young people a little bit more, which I think is great, because both you and I think are very interested in helping young people, or people in general, become more connected and learn more about weather and climate.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's that was my main core reason for joining, was not necessarily I see myself as useful or even early career, but mostly because I wanted to be supporting young people. And so the kind of work that we've been doing recently, so apparently I'm still thought of as quite young, Aisha, because they got me to do the social media post, how to communicate via social media. So what's been your contributions to the SIG recently? Because there was some good discussions in the last meeting. So what are you up to with the SIG at the moment?
Absolutely. So so actually, my first experience with the Royal Meteorological Society was through their early career conference. I presented some of my master's work there. And so I've definitely been doing some work in helping to advise on the early career conference. So I spoke on a panel for the last one, for example, about sort of careers and youth and then how to get involved. And then also I've been providing a bit of guidance as well about diversity. So that there's also this Royal Meteorological Society, oh, I can't remember the exact name, but it's a group about diversity and people of colour. And I've been basically providing some opinions and some sort of more personal reflections on what I think that group could involve and who I think should be in it, and what kind of events might be interesting and engaging for people of colour who are early career and who are interested in getting involved more in weather and climate, which I think we all know can be quite a white space at times.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, she says as a white person, you know, so and I, because I have that privilege within this sector, is that, you know, I might be
on the, you know, LGBTQ community, but I am still white and I still have got that privilege. And I think that these kind of things that are taking place are so, so important. But, you know, to get more, you know, representation of all these kind of groups, you know, women, people of color, and the thing that's happening with, let's see if I can get off, we've got a, well, by the time this episode is out, folks, this event might have already taken place because it's the 26th of March. So, for example, on Tuesday, the 26th of March, there's the next Diverse Voices event from the Royal Mitch Social Society. So that's from the Youth and Early Career Special Interest Group. So Diverse Voices, Senior Academics of Colour, join for the second of our Diverse Online series. So there's going to be more. So I'll put a link in the description for the series, and please, please do look out for that, because that's really cool. So yes, that's the kind of stuff that myself and Aisha are kind of involved with. And would you say, therefore, you know, with your absolute dedication and passion to diversity, and as you said yourself, particularly like enhancing voices from the global south, you know, these things are so, so important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really brilliant that the Royal Meteorological Society has put the time and investment into bringing in people like myself to give our opinions. I think it can be quite easy to think that we don't have much to say because we're young and we don't have a lot of experience. But actually, I think that's why it's so good to have our voices in a way. Yeah. We can maybe provide slightly different opinions or just say things that other people might not have thought of. So actually, I think it's a really useful space for us to all just be able to chat and bounce ideas off each other and think of new ideas.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think anyone working in education will understand that, you know, there's the new buzz saying going around at the moment is that no student, no young person in the classroom comes with a blank slate. You know, it doesn't matter how old they are. They could be in reception in, you know, 4 or 5 years of age, or they could be starting secondary school at 11 years of age. They've got, you know, they've still got all of that life experience and all of the knowledge that they brought with. So it's so, so important. And I'm really glad of it. And the rule, you know, any establishment with the word royal in it, you know, I've been born out of colonial entities by definition. So because they were commissioned back in the day by the, you know, by the monarchy and whatnot, or by royal decree or something like that. So they are born from a colonial process. And so it's necessary to have voices like yourself in there.
Mm. You know, so, weirdly, yeah. I never actually thought of that, the meaning of the word royal in there. I've just,
Yeah. So it's good. So, and I think it's so, so important, therefore, to have institutions with the words, you know, not just Royal Meteorological, but Royal Geographical Society as well. All these things, you know, that they are leading, they should be leading the way, really, when it comes to things like this and putting people traditionally with a marginalised voice front and centre and be giving them the power to make changes. So I'm very excited to see what we come up with next, and hopefully I'll be able to contribute more than just as how to do social media posts.
Although that's also very, very important. I think we all can agree.
True. Yeah. Right. There's two more things we're going to end with. First thing is we want to spill the beans, Aisha, because we like to get to know the people behind the geography and whatnot. And that is, you absolutely adore sports. And when you're not working, we can probably find you on the badminton court, doing a bit of gym or dancing, or absolutely whooping some backsides in martial arts. So you didn't. That's not your wording. That was my wording. I put on there. So yeah, you're a bit. You like a bit of sport. Is there any? Yeah. So it's quite a mix. I mean, they all involve, I guess, coordination. Well, most. This is such a stupid thing to say that all sports involve coordination and balance and stuff like that. But these in particular, I mean, maybe with the exception of, but martial arts, gym and dancing, I even see martial arts and self-defense stuff like that was almost like a kind of dance. So it seems to be very, very body, like focusing on the body rather than focusing on an entity like a ball or something like that, with the exception of badminton. So yeah, tell us a bit about your sporting nature.
I mean, I have to say, I am not particularly coordinated at all. I don't know if I'm showing it right now. Massive bruise on my finger. I smashed a weight into my hand at the gym last week. So I get injured a lot from the sport. I should say I'm not coordinated in the slightest.
That's quite gruesome. Yeah, I'm glad we're doing a podcast.
but yeah, I mean, I started dancing when I was a kid. I actually do an Indian type of dancing called Kathak, which was
maybe talking about culture, this was the main, other than food, my main connection to my culture. It's a North Indian classical dance style that my sister and I have been practicing since we were five years old. And so that was my introduction into sport, I guess, is I used to do a lot of Kathak, and then I moved into Bollywood as well. I'm sure most people have heard of Bollywood movies, so I did a lot of that kind of dancing. But then my father also plays squash to a very, very high level. And so we were often on the squash court, and then there was a badminton court nearby that we would often, this is like our family Saturday day, do a bit of dancing, play a bit of squash, go get some Chinese food. So sport has always been a really important part of my life. It's a really good way of letting out some stress and bonding with people and just relaxing. So for me, after a long, hard day of work, I really just want to get out of the house, especially because I work from home, right? So I just sit in front of my desk at home all day. I really just want to get out of the house and do something active where I can be around people and like connect with them, but without having to really focus on having in-depth discussions with them for 4 hours at a time, you know.
Yeah, because what we do, it does involve a lot of in-depth discussion, and yeah, you just want to get out, just smash a badminton or shuttlecock or something, you know.
Stress out.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I've been trying to go swimming Monday mornings to try and do that, to kind of de-stress, because I haven't been picked up. I used to do yoga and stuff like that, but I keep saying I need to get back into it, but you know.
But mornings, though, are you a morning exercise person? Because I am not.
I forced to be. I'm actually night owl, so I don't know. I mean, surely there's got to be some kind of sporting exercise regime for night owls. If not, we should set up a charity.
I mean, my gym is 24 hours, so I'm up in there at 10 p.m., which is great for me.
There you go. Yeah, the only other time I ever experienced a 24-hour gym was when I was living in America for a bit. Because, you know, seemed to be out there all the time. So are you definitely more of a participant than a watcher of sport?
Definitely. I have to say I find watching sport a bit boring. Am I allowed to say that? I mean,
of course you are.
If I'm watching it live, it's great. I'm going to watch the Yonex Badminton next weekend with my mum and my grandmother. My grandmother also is a really great badminton player. So that'll be really fun. And it's a day out and there's a crowd and there's an atmosphere. Watching it on the TV is maybe not so much my vibe.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I can see that. I mean, I don't bother watching sport on TV anymore. I mean, you know, when bigger tournaments come around, maybe. But yeah, I think going to see it live, I think is such a different experience. And I do have a sport bucket list. I've managed to go to Wimbledon. Mm. I've seen the Wimbledon women's final and the doubles final. I've been to the Formula One just to tick that off. But that was on the back of a field trip, a school field trip, you know.
Oh, so amazing.
I got to go for free, so I ain't gonna pay. I don't pay for that kind of stuff. Seen plenty of football, rugby, Six Nations. So I've got a few things on my bucket list to tick off. So when the 2012 Olympics came, I saw the judo and one of the football matches. The judo was quite cool. So, because my dad loves judo.
Cool. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, yes, like my dad is a like black belt in some martial arts stuff. My brother does a lot of mixed martial arts. So I'll watch them. Like if they do something, I'll watch a video of them. That's a family thing. So it's cool. Okay. But it is also terrifying to see them just getting beaten up or beating up other people.
But the amount of discipline that comes from it, I wonder as well, because my nephew does that kind of stuff as well. So apparently it's, my sister said, it's really, really helped to build his confidence, which is great.
Oh, yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, so we got just one final thing to do before we have to go. And that is the game We Are All Geographers, where we link everybody together. So all our guests get linked together by a single word or a phrase that they have to link to their passions for geography in the big sense, you know, not just geography as in the subject or something, but geography, just the broader net makes a sense. So last episode we heard from Dave Wynn, and Dave Wynn is works as a sustainability officer, is very passionate about climate change. And me and him were on a podcast about climate change in science fiction, which was geeked out on that for sure. So that was cool. And then when I asked him to come up with a word for you to talk about for 30 seconds, Aisha, he came up with the word dungeon.
Oh my God. Okay.
I don't have any control of what the guests give as a word.
Oh,
so
goodness. Okay.
And you can be philosophical about it. You can use it as an analogy. You can use it in any way, shape or form. It doesn't have to be literally something from the medieval times.
All right. Okay.
So for 30 seconds.
Right, so for me, I think you think of the word dungeon and you think of this dank, dark, horrible place where nothing can survive, right? There's no sun, there's no life, there's no nothing. But actually, I think one thing we all know as geographers is that life finds a way to survive anywhere. So even in the deepest, darkest dungeons, you're going to have interesting mushrooms and fungi and maybe bacteria that can live down there. You're going to still have this whole ecosystem of mosses and ferns, and there's going to be a water cycle, a carbon cycle down there. There's going to be all of this interesting life and the diversity. So I think maybe this is to show how even, even in a place you think we don't have good geography, we can find something there.
That's brilliant. Okay, Dave, I don't know if you were trying to trip our guest up here this time. They don't know who the following guest is, so they're not, it's nothing personal. But there you go. Smashed it. Well done.
Amazing.
Yeah, right. And so therefore, you get to have a go now yourself to pass on to the next guest. So do you have a word in mind or a short phrase? It could be something you've talked about or something completely out of the blue.
I think given what we've just been talking about, I'm going to go for the word culture.
That's surprisingly, I don't think in four seasons of Coffee and Geography we've actually had the word culture yet, which is surprising, really.
Ah, okay.
I have to double check, Aisha, but you're either close to or maybe. No. This is brilliant. But I don't. You may be, if not very, very close to be. I should have checked this in advance. My 100th guest. So.
Amazing.
So in 100, yeah, that's first time. That's a brilliant word. Excellent. Good. Perhaps nobody's come up with it because they thought, oh, that's too obvious. No, culture, that's a brilliant word. No, thank you so much. That is amazing. Right, so do you have any shout outs you'd like to give? I know you've mentioned your family, your boyfriend, anyone else?
This is going to sound so sucker feet, but I want to give a shout out to my colleagues at Carbon Brief because they are awesome. They took me on when I had zero journalism experience at all. I don't know what possessed them to do that. But I've had a great time and they have been so patient in teaching me how to be a good journalist. And I've had a great time with it. So I would like to shout out to them.
Oh, bless them. Well, you know what? They've obviously done very, very well to kind of support you on that, because weren't you nominated for an award?
Journalism Award. I was shortlisted for the Association for British Science Writers Newcomer of the Year last year.
There you go.
Very cool.
So the people at Carbon Reef are like, yeah, we knew that talent. We could spot it when we see it. No journalist experience. Boom. Finalist of an award. No, brilliant. If people want to kind of get in touch and say, because they really enjoy what they hear and want to ask you about your work or whatever, what's the best way that you can they can get in contact with you?
Probably on Twitter, or the app which formerly was known as Twitter, at Aisha Tanden, or on LinkedIn, again, Aisha Tanden. And I check those very frequently, so you can get in touch with me there.
That's so cool. Oh, this has been such a great chat. We had a bit of technical difficulties, folks, just say. So if you heard a slight change in sound quality, that's why it is. But it all worked. It's all been edited together. It's all going to sound great. And I know that as well as I know that everyone's enjoyed the listen, Aisha. So thank you so, so much. And I'm looking forward to continue collaborating with you and working with you because it's been a blast. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kit. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, it helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter at @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.